Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. I'm Lauren Petrovic, and thank you for joining me. If you're new to this podcast, we bring together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders, and CEOs shaping the future of luxury. Today, I'm sitting down with Kendall Niedermeyer, a powerhouse in the luxury real estate space and a key player on the top performing Singer team at Brown Harris Stevens. But Kendall's journey to the world of high stakes real estate is anything but ordinary. I really loved sitting down with Kendall and hearing her journey, which is one of resilience, reinvention, and relentless pursuit of excellence. From her early days as a competitive gymnast to launching a career in high fashion, working with some of the biggest names in fashion, to launching her own couture performance apparel brand, and now dominating the high-end real estate markets in both New York and South Florida. We dive into the parallels between fashion and real estate, the art of relationship building in business, and Kendall's mission to empower more women to become homeowners. Plus, Kendall shares insights on the future of luxury real estate, including the rise of wellness real estate, and opens up about her personal life, including her marathon training and finding personal life balance in fast-paced industries. Whether you're a real estate enthusiast, a creative entrepreneur, or someone looking to redefine luxury on your own terms, this episode is packed with insights you won't want to miss. So let's dive right in. Kendall, hi. I'm so happy to see you.
Likewise, Lauren. How are you?
I'm so good. Very excited to finally have you on the podcast. We've been talking about this for so many months now.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I've been looking forward to it all week as well, knowing that it was this close.
Me too. Can we start by telling everyone a little bit more about you and your incredible journey? Maybe start with your childhood and your journey to New York.
Yeah, for sure. So I grew up in Connecticut, so not too far, and I was a highly competitive gymnast. That really is what my entire world revolved around. Had hopes of making it to the Olympics, of course, came nowhere close to achieving that. It's very competitive. And then outside of my gymnastics career, my passions were designing competitive leotards, and I loved working with my hands. I would do cross-stitch projects. And I would say I was 18 when I moved to New York City. At this time, I was honestly physically and emotionally burnt out as a gymnast. And it was my first transition because growing up, I always thought that I would take a full ride, go to university, and after gymnastics at university, that I would open my own gym and that I would specialize in physical therapy for my athletes. But mentally, physically, I was in a different place at 18. And so I refocused and really drove into my passion of design and moved to New York City in the late 90s and went to the Fashion Institute of Technology, which was a really wonderful experience.
Yeah, which is where you and I met at the recent alumni program.
It is. It was the inaugural alumni.
Yes. So it's amazing to me because hearing you, you've always had this very competitive spirit and competitive nature about you.
Yes.
And there was always this room for, it seems, definitely fashion was always along the lines. Competitive nature. I want to get into your marathon journey.
Yes.
These are the core components that it seems have always been a common.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So moving to New York City at 18 years old and starting to attend FIT, living in Connecticut, you're not too far from the city, but moving here full time, how has this city started to shape more of your worldview, more of your career aspirations? I know you said before wanting to open up a gym, which I had no idea about.
Yeah. You know, honestly, it's so humbling living here. I think being a New Yorker has made me a more empathetic person. We experience things at a faster pace and more rapidly, just given the nature of the density of our population. And I think having such a dense population means there's always someone, if not thousands, that are better than you. And so it really keeps your hustle strong. And yeah. I think we're a city of competitive individuals.
It's so well said. I love that part. I think there's something so unspoken there, too, where it's like, our reality here in the city is exponentially faster and so much more competitive than almost anywhere else in the world.
What I find really interesting is your early career working at these incredible fashion houses. And soon after going to FIT, you could share some of your experiences working at some of the brands like Neem Khan, Rimacra, Halston, J. Mandel. How did you first break entry into those major brands? What was your experience there?
Yeah, so I went a route that was unique, and this will date me. So when I was job searching, there were still classifieds. The internet was not what it is now. And so I knew that I wanted to have a very unique experience. And I didn't necessarily want to take a job that was just available. What do I mean by that? I put together these little mini portfolios and I walked around the streets without appointments, looked up the designers' offices, and I literally just walked through the front door and saw who had time for me. And it was really surprising. I can't say that's the nature of the business anymore. Maybe it is. But for me, I literally went out on the streets with my little mini portfolios, my actual portfolio in hand, because of course, again, you didn't have your portfolio on an iPad as artists do now. And I met with a lot of these founders immediately. Most of these brands, although they're upwards of 40 million, they're still small businesses. The founder, owner is the creative director, and I was fortunate enough to get in front of them, and that's how I made my way in, honestly. The experience, I would say, was cutthroat. It was fast-paced. It was relentless. It was beautiful. It was all the things.
Was this like mid-2000s?
Yeah, exactly. So I graduated early 2000s. I was a 9/11 FIT student. I think that really defined us, to be honest. At my particular table, at the alumni table, we definitely talked about that, which was interesting to me. At any rate, yeah, so it was the early 2000s. And we created 6 collections a year. So there's 4 ready-to-wear, 2 bridal. We did red carpet dressing. We did bespoke dressing, of course. And so there's this creativity through the team that really builds each season. It comes to its absolute best that it can possibly become. And then there's honestly this level of like blues after the show is over. And then you don't have much time to really absorb those blues. And I think that's fair in all things in life, you know, like acknowledge success, acknowledge something that didn't go your way, but then move on as quickly as possible. Because again, it's just so fast paced here.
Yeah. There's this unspoken thing about, I would imagine you guys fed off of each other's creativity. And there's almost like this psychic type of communication going on where ideas are, you know, the room of the students that you're in were shaping one another.
Absolutely.
So I want to also talk, when was it? So you were working with many of these fashion companies for a couple of years, and then it wasn't until, was it 2017, you launched your brand F-Words?
Yeah.
Inspired by this incredible, very elegant and sophisticated lifestyle of equestrian. You started creating and cultivating more clientele in that lifestyle space. So can you tell us how it was launching that brand? Because launching a brand is not easy.
No, you know it.
People take it for granted.
For sure.
You know, it's your heart and soul in there. So how were you inspired by the idea for the brand?
Yeah.
How did you first get it off the ground?
Oh my goodness. So I was first inspired by the brands. And again, the brand and the business model changed. I think that's really important to stay nimble. And those are some of the things that you can do when you're self-funded, as I was.
Yeah.
So
I hear that.
Exactly. Actually, when it started, this may be a surprise to you, but it was meant to be much more ski focused, which makes sense, right? Because I'm a skier. And so the concept was that I wanted to manufacture couture performance apparel in the garment center here. The industry was changing so much, and I hated seeing that factories and ateliers were closing because they just didn't have enough work, because evening gowns were just not in demand as much as they were before. And so I created this special machine with a machine maker in Massachusetts retrained my sewers essentially to sew from chiffon to stretch fabrics. Anyways, long story short, it was supposed to be ski. It was ski jackets, ski pants, and it was really lifestyle and travel. And it was really about where their legacy pieces. So that, yes, they were very expensive, but they were pieces that were going to last and that you can hand them down ostensibly to your kids, truly. And in knowing that a lot of my clients would not have access to having huge dressing rooms in their homes, how can you get more out of a jacket and have less of them in having smaller spaces, right? So the obstacle I was against doing a ski collection was you have to seam seal the seams. And I'm getting like super technical.
No, this is good. I like it. I love it.
To make it waterproof, and I really wanted it to be performance driven. I didn't want it just to be fashion. I wanted it to really be for an athlete who actually cares about looking good and having great quality. And so there was only one atelier in the garment center who did seam sealing.
Are they still around today?
They are still around today. They have actually moved to New Jersey because of space. The seam sealing machine is actually really large. So the problem with that is space in the city is money, right? So, and the machine itself was hundreds of thousands of dollars. And to train someone and get it fixed, it was so cost prohibitive that by the time it came to costing out my garments, the jackets would have been thousands of dollars. And there were, you know, we sold out of our initial collection. We had clients even coming in from Switzerland that were new and found us. But it was so niche. It was like so crazy hyper niche. And so I pivoted almost inadvertently, which was such a beautiful blessing, into equestrian. And to answer your question about how did I start, I was self-funded and I was bootstrapping. And so I really wanted to make my money count. When I launched in 2017, the first 6 months, even though I had an e-commerce site, most of all of my business, quite frankly, really was from in-person pop-ups. And I stayed in the New York metro area, and 100% of the orders were bespoke. Everything was made to order. I did not carry inventory. And then going into 2018, that gave me enough data to move into the next model, which was just-in-time inventory. So just-in-time inventory meant that I could manufacture small batch inventory runs here locally in the garment center, sell out of them, and then replenish, just keep replenishing. And that really kept my capital risk as low as possible.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because a lot of these clients appreciate this very bespoke, made to order piece. It's not 10, 20 sitting on a rack in a big department store. Another thing that was really funny, you mentioned just in time inventory. And I learned about this from one of my diamond suppliers. And they mentioned this must have been back in the 80s or 90s, but the model for the diamond district used to be just in time for diamonds. So they would be able to ship goods 2 days overnight from India to New York, which is interesting. Another thing too, an important step for you along this amazing career of yours was making those relationships with the garment district, because the garment district holds a very close place to your heart and you want to see them thrive and succeed. So now with where you are in real estate, which we'll touch in a few minutes, it serves as a really important chapter for you, because now what you're doing, you're able to give back in a way, in a capacity you're able to with F-Words. So that leads me into the next question, which is, what are some of the most valuable lessons that you took away from your previous life in fashion?
Oh, gosh. I would honestly say that so much of what I took away was focusing on solutions, not problems, really not getting stuck on disappointment, keeping things moving, developing resiliency, and utilizing creativity. And I think that those are so versatile and so well played for me in real estate and just in life in general.
Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, so segueing more into what I'm really excited to talk with you about, which is navigating the high-end real estate market here in New York. Your journey from the fashion industry to luxury real estate space is very interesting. Can you share your experience transitioning from the world of fashion to luxury real estate and how the opportunity came about to join the Singer team?
To be honest, it felt so much more organic than I expected. And I think that's largely in part to the fact that I was a self-funded entrepreneur for the 8 years prior. And given those life lessons that I just mentioned, really helped set me up to come in with a level of success. So it's really interesting, I think, how I found Leslie. So now it's sort of like fast forward 25 years from when I was dating myself about the classifieds, right? So now we're in the age of technology. And I found Leslie from an Instagram reel. And she was so incredibly engaging. And she was so chic. I could just tell how experienced she was. And I could honestly tell that her level of empathy was unique. And so the same that I had done when I started my career in fashion, I just reached out to her. Because the worst thing that can happen is someone doesn't respond or they just say no. A lot of people, now I'm coming up on my 1 year anniversary of the transition, being at Brown Harris Stevens with the Singer team. A lot of people who are independent agents have asked me the similar question. And especially in regard to the Singer team is honestly one of the number one teams in the entire city. So not only did I make a transition into real estate, I jumped right into the absolute top and the absolute luxury. And independent agents have asked me, how have I done this? And it's truly, it's connections and authenticity. And so Leslie and I decided to meet. We actually met on, oh goodness, because it was in April and it was the eclipse. And so the eclipse was literally happening during our initial meeting. And I thought that that was so character developing. And I was so curious to see how she would approach that, if she would interrupt our meeting or acknowledge it. Yeah. And she's just so in tune and flexible. We literally got up in the middle of our interview, went outside on the street and looked at the sun together, of course, with her glasses. And it's just, long story short, we had such a connection. And Brittany, who has been with her for 10 years, we had such a connection. And there's not a day that goes by that I'm not so grateful that they took me under their wing, that they trust me with their clients, right? And that they're equally as excited for the business and the clients that I'm going to bring in, that we're going to nurture together.
Absolutely. Especially mentioning the lunar eclipse, it's one of those moments where it's such a bonding experience. I remember that day when everyone was outside, to watch everyone feel so connected as a community was one of the most beautiful things to see.
Wasn't it?
It was
New York moment.
Such a New York moment. And also, too, just so memorable for both of you guys, because it was the first time you guys were meeting in person. And now you guys are one of the top performing teams. And I don't think you got there because of luck. I think, like you mentioned before, you were already successful in all your previous endeavors. And it was just the right time, the right opportunity, and the right people coming together to create more shared success together. So I love it. Diving deeper into the real estate market, you have a good handle here in the city and clients in South Florida. I wanted to ask how you're able to navigate both of those markets, because I'm sure there's diverse preferences and demands for both of these clients. What are some common needs and expectations from the clients that you seek in both of these areas?
Oh, yeah. So that's interesting, because they do have such personalized searches. And even within the areas, there are so many differences. But in regard to commonality, I would say that there's a demand for a luxury experience. So a really personalized showing and way of negotiating their offer. And so we're focusing on quality. We're focusing on return on investment. It's that exclusive experience. I would say that those are the commonalities, because otherwise you're absolutely right. I would say in New York City, I have four main markets, buyers and sellers. A lot of them are first-time home. A lot of them are move up, I like to call it. Some of them are what I like to call downsize. And then, of course, we have our luxury. So those are the investors, the eight-figure and up homes, pied-à-terres, multiple homes throughout the country. And I would say in Florida, It's probably too, for me right now at least, between buyers and sellers, it's a lot of downsize and luxury. And within those markets, say, and we'll probably touch on the luxury experience, but our buyers and sellers in Coconut Grove, Miami, for instance, it's really about the deep dock. And up in Palm Beach, it's really about finding a parcel, which is next to impossible, but possible, on Ocean Boulevard that has a parcel on the beach, but which is not divided by the road. South Ocean Boulevard or North Ocean Boulevard. And so those parcels are hard to find.
So the parcel, meaning they're actually on the beach, separated, you're driving on the road, and then turning right is into the property on the parcel land.
So yeah, the way that Ocean Boulevard on South and North work, most of the estates there, the South Ocean Boulevard runs in front of their house. So their house would be set back from Ocean Boulevard, and then in front of Ocean Boulevard would be the beach. And so they own that parcel to a certain point of where the water is, and they can build cabanas there. And some of the interesting things that they've sort of come to find for solutions for some of these buyers that can't get around having the street in front of their house, because there are literally very few where the Ocean Boulevard doesn't disconnect the beach. So some of the home buyers have actually been granted, they're building tunnels underneath the street, like these luxury tunnels,
Wow. Which
is really wild. So that's kind of like the future of solving that issue.
I would love to go inside one.
Yeah, same. Yeah, I've actually yet to be, but yeah.
So clients in New York, clients in Florida, do you find a similar approach with both prior with your fashion clients and now with these high-end real estate clients?
Oh, yes, definitely. So the same between my high-end fashion clients creating a relationship and nurturing that relationship as it is now in their home buying or selling process. Step one is trust.
Yeah.
It's a relationship business. Both of them are relationship businesses. Everything else comes naturally after that. And you build that trust, I believe, through empathy, through authenticity, through listening, truly listening. And that's so exciting to be a part of building, creating, finding whatever it is that they're dreaming about, right? Would you say it's the same doing a bespoke piece of jewelry for your clients?
You know, it's so funny you ask that, because I was just going to say, yes, because I would also add one more thing to that, and building that trust is the vulnerability as yourself, as the business owner, the founder, and also the transparency too, because making a piece of bespoke jewelry, they have to know you like you trust you as a person to make those creative decisions. Similarly with fulfilling the dreams of your real estate clients too. I am aligned with making something. These pieces are going to be cherished forever. These are heirloom pieces that are going to be passed down for many generations and capture these moments and these stories and capture the energy of a person. So yeah, I mean, even with engagement ring clients, last night I went out, I live in the city. I went all the way out to Long Island to go visit a client.
Wow.
They can't make in the city. And you know what the pain is.
Yes.
Going out to Long Island. It's doing those things because I think those actions, they see that you care about them. And
yes,
those moments, they are able to build trust. They're like, I don't know who else would make these sacrifices for me. So shifting gears a bit, I think what's so unique about you is you have such a graceful spirit, but you're also so, I want to say, firm. We haven't been in business, but so I could see firm in business, which is such a like a delicate balancing act, especially being a woman in business, but also being able to carry that elegance. How do you manage to understand the person's needs and emotions deeply right in front of you, while also staying clear-headed and decisive to ensure success of the project or deal that you're working on?
Yeah, I think purchasing or selling a home is so deeply personal. And so it's really, again, about building that trust. And I think one of the things I value so much for having joined a team and a brokerage, which is one of the best brokerages in the state.
The best.
That trust also comes from those actions, and it also comes from the experience that is backed by the Singer team and the combined experience of our EVPs at Brown Harris Stevens. Sometimes the market can feel like hurry up to slow down. And when the opportunity is right, you have to move quickly because it is competitive, especially at that juncture of the deal. My clients depend on me, now that they've granted me their trust, to educate them when to be decisive, when and how to be creative. And I think that being decisive honestly comes from the confidence of life experience and trusting your gut.
Yeah. One of the two biggest things you mentioned there was, I was going to ask you a question, but you already answered it. How are you able to, when you're working with a client and selling your service or your product, not to come across as too salesy or too inauthentic? You mentioned being able to educate the client and enlighten them on when they should be decisive and when to act. Also educate them on when to be creative on a project. I think a lot of times people need that approval to be creative.
Totally.
So when you give them that torch to run with, I feel like they respect you so much and they can open it up to you a lot more. I think those are very important lessons, which I'm sure took many falls and hard times, a lot of years to learn. So let me ask, what advice or tips would you offer to those working to seek or invest in their first dream property?
Yeah, I definitely think that you should speak with a mortgage broker. You want to get pre-approved. You want to work with local experts. So you want your lawyer to be here in Manhattan. You want your mortgage banker broker to be here in New York City. There are specific requirements that they're just experienced with. I find this a lot with first-time investors. Maybe they're new to New York. And so they've purchased or sold homes where they are from, could be California, could be Colorado, you name it. And each state has a unique set of laws, which are part of the process of purchasing a home. You definitely want to deal with the experts in those areas. Local mortgage, local lawyer. You definitely want to consider smaller apartments in more desirable neighborhoods. Be prepared for a competitive market. So again, it's like hurry up to slow down and then move really quickly again. And you have to be open to compromising. Compromise is so much a part of life. And again, this is about educating. So it's not about scolding of a compromise and oh, shucks, you're just not there yet. It's about having a really open banter about how to sort of categorize those compromises and know where your boundaries are. And you know what? Maybe it means renting another year or two, and these things are all okay. There's some level of excitement and disappointment. It's a real roller coaster when it's your first home. It's so exciting because they're so
emotionally charged. Yeah. I wanted to open up more on some of your female first-time home buyer clients.
Yeah.
Last time we spoke, you mentioned some really surprising data points for single women buyers.
Yeah.
So I want to open up that conversation a little bit more and talk more about your new approach with these clients.
Yeah. So it's so interesting that it's such a small percentage of the population that women who own homes. It's about 3%, which is just so wild. It's such a mission for me. I have so many friends from my run group that are single and want to purchase a home. And it's some of my most fulfilling conversations and showings and negotiations to be able to navigate them in this really to be part of that 3%. It's like, what an honor, you know,
so
when you get
empowering.
It's so empowering. And there's no reason it can't be done, that we can't increase that percentage. And quite frankly, women tend to have a higher life expectancy. So let's get them into these homes.
I think there's definitely huge underrepresentation by women. And I think real estate is one of those overlooked industries. Yes, we have female business executives in the real estate space, but I haven't heard so much about. Maybe you've heard more because you're in this niche space. I definitely want to see those numbers go up and get more of that into this conversation.
Yes. It's kind of like Leslie has these clients right now. They're so amazing. They have this fund. I was just so excited. They have this investment fund, which is female focused. Their concept is you can invest as little as $5,000, which you would put into a designer bag, but you're putting it forward into this female founded world, which is so undercapitalized. And so if you look at it in that perspective of if they're starting a business as you are a woman running your own business, it's so incredible. You're part of that small percentage. So it's the same as when you're purchasing a home, right? It's these are the investments in ourselves, into our female community. So I think we have to stick together and be really creative about finding how to get that number up. And maybe it's the answer, the same thing, you know, putting away, instead of buying that bag that year, you're putting that into
this next
piggy bank of future
next generation. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so true. I find too, especially women in finance, women in tech, I love seeing stories about female founders. One of the statistics too, I think it was also in the single digits where compared to men, you know, I think that's like less than 2 or 3%.
Wow.
Female founders get in correlation to male founders. But always good to bring more of this coalition of women in, because, and that's, you know, one of the reasons why I started this podcast was responsible luxury carries this overarching philosophy of how can we lead better businesses? How can we lead better lives and be able to create a more sustainable, more flourishing next generation following us? Because at the end of the day, that's what we're here to do as people and humans, is take care of this place as much as we can and make it even better than when we step foot here. And so
I literally have goosebumps, like truly. That is so beautiful. And again, it's about taking the actions, and it's easier said than done. It's amazing.
Let's go into a little bit of Kendall's more personal life and lifestyle. I love following all of your stories on Instagram. I watched the one of actually you and Dan running this morning in the snow, which is so crazy. Can you share with everyone what your typical morning routine looks like?
Yeah. So, oh my gosh, what more could Dan want for his birthday today than a training run at sunrise in the snow? I mean, I gave it.
I love it.
Yeah. So my morning starts, the alarm goes off at 6:15. I am a morning person naturally. So I like to run before I start my day. I personally only run outside religiously when the sun is up. And again, this is because I'm a woman. I run outside usually by myself. Dan has just only recently starting the jog with me because he has decided he wants to run his first marathon with me. I'm out there training with him.
You inspired him.
I did, and I love it. I've never in a million years thought that he would ever run a marathon with me. Like, this is huge. So I'm up at 6:15. I run with the sunrise. I do 5 runs a week, 8 miles. Doesn't matter, as you just saw, if it's snowing, if it's raining, if it's crazy blustery wind gusts, if it's crazy humid. Oh my God, this past summer was bananas humid. It was like always 90% before the sun rose. But I push through. So when I come in from my run, I have my coffee. I'm looking at what's new to the market. And then I'm in the office by 11. Afternoons, I'm usually showing with clients. And then post-work, I'm usually meeting with my sphere of influence, reconnecting with old and new friends. And then when I rescind to home, Dan and I catch up on the sofa. I have a glass of wine. He's a whiskey drinker. And seriously, we watch reels together. We watch funny reels together. And then it's bedtime.
What do you do to figure out that balance between fast-paced career and then also taking care of personal life? Because I know a lot of times when you're working so hard, the easiest things to put at stake is personal relationships, you know, your marriage, interpersonal relationships. When did you get to that point, or have you always been that way where it was easy to figure out the schedule, where you're able to do it all and still enjoy it all?
Yeah, I'm a creative, as are you. So I feel like I've always needed to structure my day. And that really defines me. And within that, I find myself grounded. And so I've always sort of had a clear set of boundaries for myself to protect my energy. Yeah. I've always been deeply in tuned to the energy of myself and of others. I think that because I'm so empathetic, I have to also protect that, right? So I think it came quickly from experience. And so it's always been a non-negotiable to run. Running is meditative for me. It's really like my flow. And then in regards to my personal life with my husband, right? It'll be 16 years this month.
Wow.
I know.
Congratulations.
In New York, that's like forever.
Yes.
Thank you.
The secret to a long and happy marriage is making your husband get up at 6 a.m. on his birthday.
On his birthday and run in the snow. You heard it here first. Exactly. Oh my gosh. So that's the kind of, I guess that is truly though, right? Because we always said one of our priorities would be to grow with each other, right? Because we're not going to be the same people through our whole lives. And so to continue to love each other through those growth changes and support each other and empower each other through those. And so we've always taken that time to try to enjoy the things that each other like. And some of us learn to like them more than others, but he is going to run that marathon.
I mean, it's such an attractive thing when partners are able to motivate and push one another, because
yeah,
that's when you see that growth and that change happen. But you see relationships, and when people grow, like you mentioned, you want to grow together. And sometimes, you know, I've seen so many times long, short relationships, people grow in different directions.
Yes.
On different wavelengths. And like, that's when you lose each other.
Yeah.
So it's like, how can you find that common ground again?
Yeah. And I think it was very important as well. We also decided, especially when I started my business, and I think that this was very wise. I didn't share my financials of the business with him, because we didn't want it to come between our relationship. And so we've set that boundary just in general, that our careers will not interfere with how we grow together. I think that's important to define your priorities and your boundaries. And that's worked out well for us as well.
That's a huge key to success, because it's so easy to smear those boundaries and bring career and work in the home.
Yeah.
And your home is supposed to be this place, like, you know, a very safe haven for you to go and recharge. And so that's actually a good tip I'm taking away from you, because I feel like it's very easy to get muddled in those waters, especially when your career is so important and you want to share the downfalls, the successes with your partner.
Yeah.
So I also wanted to ask a more serious question, which you've been sharing some of your grieving moments for Alia. How these moments that you experience of loss, how has that helped shape more of your perspective on your life, building resilience and seeing the significance of relationships in your life?
Yeah. You know, we loved her entire life and we'll miss her the rest of ours. I don't mean to get teary-eyed, but it's, she was our baby and she taught us so much and how to live life. You know, everyone says that they have the best dog, and we truly had the best dog. It was a blessing that she shared her soul with us. And quite frankly, an entire community fell in love with her, both in person and online. She literally had followers from Instagram who would plan their entire trip from other countries to come to New York City and would plan their trip around when they were going to meet her because they absolutely had to meet her. And so,
anyone who hasn't seen Kendall's puppy, she was this gorgeous Dalmatian.
She was. And you know, at the end of her life, the vet, because we used to stop by every day and she would take Treatos. They had like this little Treato bar at the front. And they fell in love with her so much that truly at the end of her life, they actually gifted us 4 days of complimentary IV fluid treatments to help prolong her life. And they really supported us through at-home palliative care, which is such an emotional time and process. To see a community fall in love with her when she can't even speak truly exemplifies how actions speak louder than words, right? And if that's the biggest takeaway and what I've learned from her and about relationships is that actions speak louder than words, and be authentic, make the effort, take the action, show the love, give all the snuggles. It's totally worth it.
Yeah. Dogs give so much love and connection to a family, a community. It's great, actually, but it's also very hard to deal with that. I've dealt with a childhood shepherd very close to me. You know what it feels like because it's such a heavy hit emotionally.
It's so raw.
Something that important to you. It is so raw.
And there are no shortcuts to grieving, truly. I wish that there were.
You mentioned you see these signs of her around the city.
I do. And they continue. I mean, we can have a whole other hour of spiritual connections with Aliyah.
I love it. We should make a new podcast.
Yes. Spiritual connections with Aliyah, Lauren and Kendall. Yeah.
I love, you know, wrapping up more of the lifestyle piece. Where are some of your favorite safe haven spots in the city? Because I have some of mine I'll share with you.
Okay. Oh, gosh. Safe haven. I didn't think of it that way. Goodness. So, you know, it's been, Dan's probably lived here closer to 30 years. For me, it's a little bit more than 25. So we're both such foodies. And again, being a lover of luxury also incorporates fine dining. And for me, I love fine dining as art. The service is art, front of house, back of house, the entire hospitality aspect of that and how literally logistics it works. And so I look at when I'm going to restaurants, how inventive they are in the hospitality, because there's a lot of newness happening right now, whereas servers used to just serve and food runners used to just do food running and a maitre d' used to just seat. But now there's this whole sort of ballet, like there's this whole sort of dance where the entire team of hospitality front and back has collaborated and they take on other roles. And it feels so surprising through the service sometimes when it happens. It's such a delight for me. So when I look at dining out, it's not just about the food or the drinks. I'm also looking at that part of the atmosphere. And then for me, the other part of the atmosphere is, of course, the decor. So anyways, to answer your question, goodness, I don't know if they're safe havens as much as they're like my favorites right now. So we've lived here so long, which is such a blessing, that I feel like we try to not frequent places that much because we like to try as many new places as we can. And that's like indefinite. You can succeed at that in the city, right? So it's like, you'll never dine at all the restaurants, but we do frequent places. I guess one of my new safe havens is, and this might be like an unpopular opinion, but in Hudson Yards, which I love, and this is why it's unpopular because it's sort of polarizing. People don't feel like it's a community yet, but I do, and maybe that's partly because it is my community. I live in Hell's Kitchen, so it's just a little walk down to Hudson Yards, and I love the new La Conda Verde there. They have a downstairs bar. They have an upstairs bar. It's kind of hit all the things that I'm looking for. The food's really great. I love the lobster paquiere for two. So we go there. They only open at Thanksgiving, and we've already been there a handful of times. I guess also Casa Tua. I feel like the Upper East Side is having such a moment. It's totally coming back with inventions. Like, it is such a cool place to be again, which is so wild. And, you know, that whole area, which we're calling the Trifecta by the Carlisle and now the new Story Hotel. So the Story Hotel is so amazing because it has just recently been renovated and the residences sold out pre-sale. The Singer team brought a number of clients there. The penthouse, for instance, was originally off-market, listed around $35 million in the summer last year. By the time it actually hit the market, it was $50 million. So there were opportunities to have bought it at $35 between June and when it hit the market. I think it was sometime in December. The value already increased by $15 million, and they haven't even finished construction. Anyways, they have a restaurant.
Remarkable.
It's truly remarkable. But they have a restaurant, Casa Tua, which I adore. They have locations in Aspen and Miami. So this is their first one in New York, and that's really fun. So I do that. And then definitely like a nightcap at Bemelman's, Piano Side. Oh, that's classic. Yeah. And then lastly, I would say Clemente. I'm not a huge EMP fan. And again, unpopular opinion. And as a creative, I think that there is a difference between being inspired and how you interpret it. I remember a moment years ago that just put a taste in my mouth, so to speak, where I felt like they were interpreting what they were doing at Alinea in Chicago by Chef Grant, who happens to be one of my favorites in the world. He's so, so inventive. Like, he's beyond next level. And I mean, they basically, this is so horrible, I can't believe I'm saying this, but they basically copied his entire tasting menu verbatim. And I think it felt new to people in New York because maybe they hadn't been to Chicago, and it also was very hard to get into the tasting menu there. And so Clemente, as good as it is, and it's filling like this void in the city and it's needed, and I'm going to go back, and they have great drinks like their classic martini, which has saffron and curry. It's genius. But it's definitely a nod to Chef Grant's. He has a similar cocktail concept called the Aviary in Chicago. But yeah, so those are like my sort of three favorites, and they're all three in different areas. But what are yours? What are your safe havens and favorites?
You know, it really depends, because now I live this life. I'm in just off the cusp of Sutton Place now. So I feel like my preferences have changed so much. I am seem like one of those now where it's like I never really want to go downtown, which is terrible.
Yeah.
But I think
how times have changed.
I know. I think most recently, though, it's funny. One of my places I work at frequently is the Palace Hotel on 51st Madison.
Cool.
I'm almost afraid to release this, but I, you know, it's funny because I go there on my way to work, maybe like an hour, hour and a half in the morning, and it has become so integral in my routine. So I go there. I love the cafe there. I love the team there. They are so passionate about working there and what they do. So I love being in the lounge there. They also have this really interesting bar upstairs that it's an interesting experience. That place has always been very much of a time capsule for me because I've met so many clients. I met new clients there. I've met new collaboration and partnerships with, one of which is the spa, which I'll mention to you more about later. But that's less of food and cocktails.
Well, thank you for not gatekeeping that.
Yes. Another one I really enjoy is, I do love Bemelman's. That place is very special to me because the characters on the wall are in the little Madeline. And that was my favorite.
No,
like favorite growing up as a little girl. So it's,
I love that.
Very special to my heart. Other than that, for a safe haven, where if I want to go somewhere just for quiet space and want to be completely unbothered, there's a place along the East River I stop. There's a little bench overlooking the water, and there's never anyone there.
Nice.
So I think it's past First Avenue on Sutton Place, and it's like on like 54th or 53rd, I think. And it is just one of those places I'll go in the morning during the summertime, of course, when it's warmer, and like read a book or, you know, just sit and meditate for a little bit before going on a jog. But I'm always looking to discover new ones. In any case, wrapping up today, 1 hour is just not enough to cover everything with you. Looking more towards the future of responsible luxury,
yeah,
especially in the real estate market, What advice would you give to aspiring creatives and entrepreneurs looking to make a mark in the luxury industry?
Yeah. Leverage storytelling. Focus on quality. Create exclusive experiences and don't expect to make a lot of money. Kidding, not kidding.
So
it's a passion.
So, yes, it is a passion. It's always good to couple with another thing. Just that is, I think, really good, you know, insights for people maybe just starting off or maybe making a pivot in their career. So
yeah.
I love that. How do you see the future landscape of the real estate business evolving more? And what trends do you anticipate shaping more of the industry in the coming years, particularly in terms of personalized experiences and cutting edge design concepts?
Yeah. So there's this whole trend, which is starting now, and I see it expanding. It's called wellness real estate. And so you may or may not be familiar, there's already buildings in the city that are LEED certified, and we have the energy ratings outside most of our buildings and whatnot. But wellness real estate is sort of next level of that. And it's an actual certification. So most wellness real estate to date is commercial. So a lot of these really incredible new buildings that are commercial going up, like the Times building, which of course was built however many years ago. So the concept was really about non-toxic environments, right? So there's 10 pillars. They're surrounded around air, water, nourishment, light, movement, sound, materials, mind, and community. And so now the trend has been not just to have this in the workplace, but to have it in your residence. And so this WELL certification is now hitting the residential market. And there are those pillars which will be done. There are competing operations to WELL certified that have the same premises. So you're just going to start seeing this more. And the interesting thing about it is that it's probably immeasurable what it does to increase your quality of life. But what it does for the return on investment is already projections of almost 8% higher rents or sales price by square foot. I think this is really so interesting. And I feel like there are so many people who don't even know about wellness real estate yet. There's a really cool residential building downtown in Soho that Leonardo DiCaprio used to own in. There's like 6 homes in it. And literally when you take a shower, there's vitamin C that comes out of the water. So, I mean, it's next level.
The wellness real estate properties are new to me. The first time I've heard about them was from you. I could imagine the rigor to be a certified residential building with this and all the benchmarks you have to pass. There's no doubt in my mind there's people out there who are more than happy to spend the money on it. Do you see this becoming more attainable? I mean, 8% higher rents is,
yeah.
I mean, in New York, not very surprising because
right.
You know, rents are crazy here. Do you see more people having access to this, or do you think it's going to stay in that higher bespoke type of level of real estate?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, and I don't have the answer per se, but of the few buildings that are for rent or for sale within these requirements, there are already some rental buildings which are actually, all things considered for Manhattan standards, modest. So say, for instance, that building I mentioned downtown that Leo had purchased, there is a property which was for rent by owner recently, and that property was close to $40,000 a month. But there is a rental building with many more units than 6 homes, kind of near Nomad. And those rents are, right, closer to $7,000 a month. And that's for 2 bedrooms. And again, that's not attainable for everyone. So I take that with a grain of salt in comparison to the ultimate luxury. I think it has to be attainable in so many markets. So I wasn't planning to go there with this, but just in regards to that, the first thing that comes to my mind is the rebuilding of California after these horrible, atrocious fires, right? So I didn't know that so many of these homes burn from the inside out. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they are not within the standards of wellness real estate. So it's how their windows were built, how their vents are built. And so the embers come through these, I don't know how else to call it, but these holes and inefficiencies, and literally burn the house from the inside out. So I think that the rebuilding of California is very much going to be within these standards because it has to survive, in which case it has to be attainable because there's nothing there and they have to rebuild everything, basically. So,
I mean, for a better standard of living, I think it's well worth it in the long run because things may seem unattainable, but there's no limit on what you're able to achieve, especially just thinking about trying to rebuild California seems like a big, really heavy lift on a lot of people. But we've seen the power of communities come together to make the impossible possible. So I would love to see more of these wellness homes.
Same, same, ditto.
Present. And Kendall, this was such a delight. You know, I feel like this episode was so well-rounded. And when I was talking with you and then coming up with some questions, I've never really gotten super personal with some of the special guests.
I really
like that. I really like that facet of it because, you know, we hear about a lot of careers and business. And I think what really connects you to something is a person, as you mentioned, the person themselves. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your morning with me. Where can our listeners find you to follow you after the show?
Yeah.
I want to reach out for hopefully maybe a real estate property or just connect.
Yeah. So our team website is singerteamrealestate.com. You can follow me on Instagram. It's at Kendall, K-E-N-D-E-L underscore runs underscore real estate. And you'll find my contacts there, I guess.
Excellent. And I'll make sure I link those down in the show notes below for you to find it easy. Kendall, thank you so much again. I hope to have you on again soon.
Likewise. Oh my gosh.
And have an amazing rest of the week. We have to grab a cocktail at one of your favorite spots soon.
Yes, please. Let's make it happen. And also, I am determined to get you to Friday Pitch and Run.
Oh, yes. I've been meaning to come.
Yes, it's fun.
Tomorrow's Friday, right?
Tomorrow is Friday. Don't come tomorrow only because it's the one Friday I have something to do. There's a speaking event for Brown Harris Stevens at Hudson Yard.
Fabulous.
So I'll be at that. But otherwise, every other Friday.
I have to make time for that.
Yes.
We'll make that happen.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right, Kendall.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Bye.
Look forward to
Ciao.
It. Cheers.
What an incredible conversation that was with Kendall. From her early days designing for top fashion houses to making a name for herself in luxury real estate, her journey is a testament to resilience, reinvention, and the power of building authentic relationships. I love how she's not just selling properties. She's really shaping the next era of luxury real estate while empowering more women to step into home ownership. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe to the Responsible Luxury Podcast so you never miss a conversation with industry leaders shaping the future of responsible luxury. And if Kendall's insights resonated with you, share this episode with a friend or leave a review. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can connect with Kendall and learn more about her work at singerteamrealestate.com and on Instagram at Kendall Runs Real Estate, all linked in the show notes below. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, keep building a life and business rooted in purpose, passion, and responsible luxury.